the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And I'm John Loeffler. As we just said, the name of the program is Lifetime Income. And, well, logically, most of the issues on the program deal with retirement. And these are issues that range all the way from maintaining long health and longevity to Social Security, to taxes, to estate planning and investing. And one of the more popular issues besides health is income, strategies for producing it, the safest investments so you that you keep what you make, how to increase income, and income inflation protection. So what we're going to do today is refocus efforts on producing income, which is critical for anyone who is retired or thinking of retiring. Today, we'll focus on alternatives to mutual funds, which most retirees use to produce income, either invested in mutual funds or ETFs.
And before we do that, John, I want to start out with what we call the basics or the main sources of income, because obviously when you retire, you're no longer working. If you had a business, you might have sold it. And so you're relying on your investments or some form of pension. And as we survey the landscape for income and retirement, you've got basically four or five areas that produce the income that allows a person to retire. One is pensions. It could be something like a defined benefit pension plan. For example, if you work for the government, the federal government, state, or local, or it might be something like a defined contribution plan. Most people refer to them as like 401k programs that you have at work, the money you put aside in those pensions. So pensions is a main source. Social Security, if you paid into the system, is another source of income. Personal savings, things that you've saved outside of a, let's say, contribution to a pension plan, the equity in your home. You might have lived in a house for 30 years. It may be free and clear, paid off, or you have a substantial amount of equity. Post-retirement employment, which is becoming increasingly more important. I think it's the last statistic that we read in a study is something like 26-28% of people over age 65 are choosing to do some kind of work, either working full-time or part-time. And then, of course, inherited wealth. Maybe you're fortunate. Your parents had a few bucks and they pass it on to you. But those are basically your five sources of income that you use to live and retire.
I guess a logical approach to this would be to look at each of those individually. And why don't we begin with pensions, which at one time, you know, people considered to be rock solid, but really are not as reliable as I think a lot of people thought. And that may actually get worse as pension plans run onto financial hard times.
You know, you bring up a good point, John, because, you know, at one time, if you worked in the private sector, you had something called a defined benefit pension plan, which means that, you know, you work so many years and depending on your length of stay with the company, you got X percent of your salary as a pension. That pretty much started to go by the wayside in the 80s, although they're still around and used heavily in the government sector. But I want to tell individuals working for government, state, local, or federal, you're going to see major changes in the next decade. Many states, my own state of California, including states of Illinois, New Jersey, are running into difficulties now because their pensions are underfunded and there's going to be a tax revolt if they keep raising taxes to fund these pensions. And so you're going to see a shift in the next decade away from these defined benefit pension plans, more to like what we have in the private sector today, 401k plans. But nonetheless, pensions are a main source of income for most individuals. In the private sector, you probably have a 401k. If you're a teacher, you probably have a 403b. And in government, you have something called a 457. Now, they're the main source of income in the private sector, next to Social Security. And if you're invested in one of these pension programs, you're more likely investing in mutual funds, which we'll get into in just a moment. But pensions, nonetheless, are the main source of income for most retirees. John, you mentioned defined benefits, which were more secure. Money was put aside. The money was given to an insurance company. And based on your life or, you know, the life of you and your spouse, depending on the option you chose, you would get a predictable income check every single month as long as you live and you weren't dependent on the whims of the market, as let's say individuals that have something like a 401k program or a 403b, or they roll their 401k program into an IRA when they retire. So we'll discuss in just a moment here more ways to make these income streams predictable. The second source of income is Social Security. And that's another source of income that's predictable. You get so much depending on your age. And then there's a small COLA each year that's added to that. And that's another source. And at one time, if you think back 30, 40 years ago, I remember when I first got in the business over 30 years ago, you know, most individuals came out of a company with a defined benefit pension plan and Social Security. And the combination of the two equaled, in many cases, exceeded what they made when they were working. So it was a great time. It was called the golden age of retirement. Now, the nice thing about Social Security for many of you today, depending on the strategies you use to produce income, if you can delay your Social Security benefits to age 70, they will go up by 32%. It's not only going to benefit you, but it also would benefit your spouse. And this is a strategy that's still underutilized today and can be very, very effective in creating predictable income, because there's very few investments out there today that can produce a guaranteed stream of income, which is what you're looking for in retirement. And along those ideas for predictable income, one is to actually work part-time when you're retired. And for many of you, that's going to be one of the few options that you're going to have. You maybe have gone through two bear markets, 2000, once again in 2007 and 9, and plus a low income environment as we are today. You may not have the options or the assets that you thought you were going to have when you got down to retirement.
Well, aside from delaying Social Security and allowing it to accumulate, this seems to be, you know, something that's maybe a little more viable because people are living longer?
Yeah, I mean, there's a number of reasons why working longer or working part-time is beneficial. Number one, it allows you a greater period of time to, let's say, accumulate assets. Let's say instead of retiring at age 65, if you work another 5 years, that's five more years you could put money aside for savings. If you're at a company, you're putting money into a 401k, the company's matching it, you're going to accumulate more assets and allow your existing assets to accumulate and grow because you're not drawing on them. Secondly, as you just mentioned, John, by delaying Social Security from age 66 or 65 to 70, it grows at 8% a year. So typically, most people get full benefits today at 66. And by delaying it to age 70, that Social Security benefit is going to go up 32%. Number three, by working longer and not drawing on your assets, you're going to have less of a drawdown of those assets. They're accumulating instead of distributing them to you in the form of income. And it's also been proven, as we have talked to many health experts here on the program, people that work longer tend to live longer. They feel productive. They have meaningful relationships in their life. And it's not unusual that we see people working into their 70s. I've got a client that works part-time and is in her 80s, and she enjoys what she's doing. She works at one of the animal shelters here, and she just loves animals. And I mean, it just makes her day going into work. And so, you know, she's living a very productive life and earning some extra income. So it's a very effective strategy to turbo boost your retirement. I had a client, he's still with us, and we're working on the third generation with his family. I started with his father, then his father referred me him as a client, and then, of course, now I'm working with his kids. He's a doctor, and when we met back in 1984, he said, you know, I want to have $1 million when I retire. Now, think back to 1984 when interest rates were double digits. And in 1984, I could have, you know, on $1 million, I could have gone into things like Ginnie Mae's government securities and gotten 14%. Imagine getting that today. And at 14%, that would have produced about $140,000 of income, which was close to what he was earning. Well, when it got to be age 65, we didn't have $1 million. We actually had almost $2.5 million. But obviously, $2.5 million doesn't buy the same goods and services today as it did in 1984. So he elected to work part-time. And by doing so until age 70, we were able to grow that portfolio to well over $3 million. And we'll get to his story a little bit later on, because one of his goals was to leave each one of his kids $1 million. He retired at age 70 and has more than enough ample income. And now he's enjoying doing what he loves to do. He has a special sport car in the group. He has photography, and two of his children live overseas. So he does a lot of travel. And by postponing, his assets grew and he is more than secure today.
Okay, so we've talked about, you know, Social Security, pension plans. Let's say, for example, you have inherited money. There's an example. You've gotten some money, and or you have an alternate source of income that doesn't factor into some of the ones we're talking about.
Well, I mean, if you have an inheritance, I mean, obviously, it's a nice windfall, and it also allows you to have assets outside of a pension plan, because most people's assets they accumulate, the bulk of it is in the equity in their house and their 401k or pension plan. The nice thing about inheritance, you know, mom and dad leave you a house, they leave you stocks or some kind of assets. You now have assets outside of a pension plan. And that's really important for tax planning, because anything that comes out of a pension is taxed as ordinary income. And that is one of the things that the client I told you about, the doctor, his goal is to leave $1 million to each one of his three children. And he will be able to do that because, you know, he was fortunate in that he went to medical school. His dad had put aside money for medical school. So when he got out of medical school, he didn't have hundreds of thousands of dollars of debt. And so he was able to start out, buy a nice house, trade up and get a bigger house, because he wasn't paying off $250,000 of medical student loans. And so this was something that he wanted to do to make the difference for each one of his children. Two of his children will be okay. One, maybe not so much, because, you know, they're struggling a little bit more. Plus, they live in California where it's just expensive to live. I have another client who has four children. In this case, his net worth is in the tens of millions of dollars. And unfortunately, three of the children just weren't financially responsible. So what we've done is we've set up a trust where they will not be able to get the principal, but they will get the income for the rest of their life. So essentially what he's done is created a private pension plan for each one of his children. So inheritance is really a nice way to go. The other one, which is common to most individuals, is personal savings. Maybe you've saved some money outside of a pension plan, or you've done what many people have done living in California or New York. You sell the big house that you grew up in and raised the family in. You take your equity and you move someplace else, or you downsize, paying cash for a home and freeing up the equity that is in your home. And that becomes another source of income for you in retirement.
Let's turn the spotlight back to mutual funds, because we're calling this alternative to mutual funds, I guess. But most people are invested in these or ETFs for retirement. So that's the core. That's the staple.
Yeah, because anybody that was saving, let's say, through a 401k, 403b, 457 plan, the options in most of these pension plans are mutual funds. And, you know, typically what will happen is an individual will retire, they roll the money over to an IRA, and they're invested in mutual funds and ETFs. The issue is, though, if you are fortunate enough where you've accumulated a nest egg of over, let's say, $500,000, there's better alternatives to mutual funds. And we're going to talk about a couple of these: individual bonds, dividend paying stocks, rental real estate, and annuities. Now, the reason alternatives work better is you have more control over the income and it's more predictable in terms of what that income turns out to be. And I want to give you a brief example of this. And you've probably experienced this if you've been invested in bond mutual funds or bond ETFs. And I always take the two popular ones because they kind of represent what people do. LQD, which is corporate bonds, TLT. I'm not getting into junk bonds, emerging market debt funds, or things like that. We'll keep it simple. And if you take a look at TLT, which you invest in long-term treasury bonds, and this will give you an example of what happens in January of 2008, it paid roughly a little over 36 cents a month per share. That dropped to 34 cents in 2009, down to 32 cents in 2010. I'm rounding this off. 2012, it was down to 28 cents. And then in 2016, when interest rates bottomed, it got down to 24 cents. Today, with interest rates rising, it's roughly 25 cents. But here's the point. From 2008 to 2018, the income dropped by over 33%. Now, if you were invested in this fund since its inception, at one time it was paying 44 cents. So it's come down considerably. If you were invested in LQD, which is corporate bonds, it was paying 47 cents a share in 2008. In 2018, it's dropped down to 32 cents a share. So income is down roughly like TLT. It's down roughly about 32%. If you invested in LQD from its inception, where it once paid 55 cents a share, your income has dropped by 42%. So if you invest in mutual funds, bond funds, or ETFs, and we'll get to even the unpredictability of stocks, you've seen your income decline by almost a third. And folks, that is not where you want to be in retirement, where you see your income decline as your expenses from everything from food to utilities to taxes to medical expenses all going up. And that's why instead of, let's say, bond funds, we like the alternative, which is individual bonds. And that's why, for example, we like floating rate bonds or individual bonds, because let's say I buy a 4% bond in 2008, which actually back in 2008, we could have bought a 5% bond. But let's say I bought a 5-year 5% bond. That income does not change over that 5-year period. It's 5% every single year. The bond matures, you get your money back. It doesn't change or fluctuate like a mutual fund. If you are invested in floating rate bonds, which is what we're doing for our clients now, as the Fed raises interest rates, as LIBOR rates go up, as the Fed funds rate goes up, the rates of return adjust upward, just like an adjustable rate mortgage. And right now, on many of these bonds, we're getting over 5% on the way to 6. So that's one thing that is more predictable. It's more controllable. Instead of declining income, you may have fixed income or rising income with floating rate bonds. So that is something that's very important when you are retired, to have something that's predictable. I mean, think of all the individuals that have been retired for 10, 15 years that have been invested in bond funds that have seen their income decline over that period of time as interest rates have been brought down to the lowest point in history. And the other danger here, if you listen to the program over the weekend when we talked about the next bear market in bonds, we talked about it's not just the fact that you've seen your income decline, but now as interest rates are heading up, you're seeing the value of your bonds drop in value.
If we could now, let's contrast individual stocks versus stock funds.
You know, this is actually one of my favorite tools. The next alternative is dividend paying blue chip stocks. So when I say dividend paying and blue chip, you're really looking at, you know, the stocks that make up the Dow, high quality stocks within the S&P 500. They're blue chips for a reason. They're established business. And I like choosing or looking at the dividend aristocrats. These are companies that have had a history of raising their dividends every single year over a 25-year period of time. I'm going to give you an example of this. I've taken 5 Dow stocks, Coca-Cola, Procter & Gamble, Microsoft, Walmart, and Exxon. And this will just give you an idea of what I mean about predictable rising income. In 2007, Coca-Cola paid 68 cents a share in dividends. In 2018, it'll pay $1.56. That is an increase of 129%. Procter & Gamble in 2007 paid $1.45. Today, it'll pay $2.85. That's an increase of 97%. Microsoft, who would ever thought 20 years ago you would see tech stocks as some of the best dividend payers? Microsoft paid 44 cents a share in 2007. Today, they pay $1.68. That's an increase, you're not going to believe this, 281%. It's no wonder the stock's in the 90s. Walmart paid 95 cents a share in 2007. Today, they pay $2.08, an increase of 119%. Exxon paid $1.55 in 2007. Today, it pays $3.14, an increase of 103%. Now, with blue chip individual stocks, you have a predictable history of rising income instead of falling income, and it's more predictable. But I want to throw this caveat. You need to be careful when you're choosing blue chip stocks that you look at dividend aristocrats, because even in an economic downturn, as we had in 2008, if you were in financial stocks, including the big banks, eliminated their dividend. Companies like GE eliminated their dividend. And so there are a lot of companies that eliminated those. That's why you want typically consumer staple companies, utilities tend to be more predictable. The Coca-Colas, the Procter & Gambles. So you got to be careful that you stick with blue chips, but more importantly, blue chip aristocrats. They got to be aristocrats. If you've raised your dividend 25 years consecutively, you've gone through one or two recessions, and if you've raised those dividends, it shows you you've got a pretty predictable business.
But Jim, there's always the consideration of a bear market. You know, the market goes down, stocks follow it. How do you handle something like that?
Well, I mean, as you get closer to a bear market, you know, we will lighten our percentage of stocks. So let's say you have, I don't know, let's say 300 shares of Coca-Cola stock. You might lighten your Coca-Cola stock from 300 shares to 200 shares, or maybe even 150, or just cut back part of your percentage of stocks. But here's the point. You're in that stock for a reason. You're in it for predictable income. And even though from, let's say, the bear market, which began, the market peaked in October of 2007. So by March of 2008, Coca-Cola lost over a third of its value. So on the surface, you might say, oh my goodness, if I had $90,000 in Coca-Cola stock, it's now worth $60,000. Oh, I've lost $30,000. But here's the thing. In 2007, Coca-Cola raised its dividend 8%. 2008, it raised its dividend 8%. 2009, it's raised its dividend. So through the entire crisis, 2007, 8, and 9, every single year, you were getting an 8% pay increase. So from 2007 to today, Coca-Cola's dividend has gone up 129%. But one of the things I like using is maybe you cut back and maybe lighten up on your holdings of your individual shares, freeing up some cash, which allows you buying power in the next downturn. But once again, you know, you stay with blue chips, you stay with the blue chip aristocrats, because once again, in an economic downturn, if you're in a cyclical business like GM, Ford, or somebody like that, that sees their sales drop dramatically in a recession, you know, these companies typically cut their dividends. So you want to be careful there. So that is something that works very well, and you can do that, and it's much more predictable versus a stock fund where you don't know what the dividends are going to be because they're always changing the portfolio. They're selling stocks, and also they go through downturns, so it's less predictable than something like, you know, I can predict more likely with a high degree of probability what your income is going to be from a Coca-Cola or a dividend aristocrat than I can from a stock mutual fund.
We probably need to factor in annuities because you've talked with a number of annuity experts here on the program and they like them. How do they fit in with all of the things we're talking about?
Well, annuities are kind of what your father and my father had, John, when they had what was called defined benefit pension plans. If you had a defined benefit pension plan, basically after 20, 30 years with the company had put X amount of dollars aside for your retirement. When you got to retirement age, they basically took that pot of money that they set aside. And then what they did is they went to an insurance company and said, based on, you know, John, your life and Carol's life, what would you provide in terms of income? And many people have various options with companies, and that's what they did. And that was your pension. Immediate annuity is the same thing. What you basically do is you're going to an insurance company and you're saying, here's a pot of money. I want to create a predictable stream of income, which I cannot outlive. And so, you know, this is something that we see a lot of people doing. What you're essentially doing here is you're handing over some assets to an insurance company for a guaranteed cash flow income for you. And generally, it's you and your spouse for as long as you live. So the income is constant, just like the defined benefit pension plan. And you cannot outlive the annuity. The longevity risk is transferred to the insurance company. So I have clients that are in their 90s that are getting income from their annuities. But just like your pension and like your Social Security, on the death of you and your spouse, the income stops. There is no income stream to your heirs or children. The only difference would be is, you know, one of the things that we'll do is we'll do something like a 10-year protection, which is a 10-year certain, which says that, hey, if both of you die before 10 years, those payments would continue to your heirs for the remaining. Let's say both of you die after 5 years, the remaining 5 years would be paid to your estate. And some annuities have what they call a liquidity option, where you can have access to, let's say, up to 25% of the principal for an emergency. Essentially, what you're doing is you're creating your own pension plan. And because that's what defined benefit pension plans were. The company didn't do that. They usually put aside money. They went to an insurance company and the insurance company handled that distribution. And as Wade Fowe and Robert Burt and many others, they have found this to be a very powerful combination when combined with something like blue chip stocks, which go up and grow over a period of time, while the annuity fills the income gap like a bond portfolio. So what we're doing here versus mutual funds is creating a growing and more predictable stream of income that grows over time and is more predictable. You can't predict if you're in an ETF or a bond fund or a stock fund what your income is going to be today or what it's going to be 5 years, 10 years down the road. And that's something that's one of the problems. Another reason is a very popular strategy used by advisors, planners, and on Wall Street is the 4% rule. Gosh, we've covered this topic a number of times. But the idea is, we'll take a simple illustration here. You have $100,000, you withdraw 4% a year. So theoretically, that income could last you for 25 years. So you're spending income and principal, but you're taking out 4% a year. Now, theoretically, in a bull market, that works really good. Here's the problem. In 2000 to 2002, the S&P 500 lost over 50% of its value. In 2007 to 2009, the S&P 500 lost 58% of its value. So imagine you're pulling out 4% a month at an annual rate of 4% when the market's going down 20% a year. It puts you in danger of something that you don't want to find yourself in, which is sequence risk, or depleting your assets early on at the beginning of your retirement. It is devastating and you may never recover. And let me give you another example. The stock market peaked in March of 2000. It went down over 50%, went back up the next 5 years, and then dropped 58%. So if you were invested in an S&P 500 index fund from the year 2000 to the year 2013, you absolutely went nowhere. So for 13 years, you earned zip, zero and you're pulling out 4% a year, can you imagine the trouble you would find yourself in 13 years later? So if you are fortunate enough to have more assets, and usually $250,000 to $500,000, I would say $500,000 is much better. There are so many better alternatives that are much more predictable and allows your income to not only remain constant, but rise over a period of time than a mutual fund. I'm not banging against mutual funds. Most 401k programs use them. But when you become fortunate enough to accumulate enough assets, there are absolutely better alternatives.
And to illustrate some of the things we have been discussing, we put it into a real life case study, which of course, as always, is an hypothetical illustration based on, you guessed it, real life examples. Obviously, names and circumstances have been changed. And for your benefit, we have put slides online at financialsense.com, which illustrate the points being made. Okay, tie this all together, Jim.
Okay, this week, we're going to talk about Nick and Kimberly Collins. Nick is age 59. Kimberly is age 61. Both are retired, and their life expectancy is 88 for Nick, 90 for Kimberly, and very, very conservative as a couple. I had a great business. Their goals are capital preservation. Nick recently retired, and though having the same advisor for two decades, came to us for a second opinion on his investment strategy and his current holdings. He's concerned about market risk given current valuations and wants to make sure he can produce enough income to meet their current and future needs. He's conservative by nature. He does not want to go through what he went through in 2008, and he can recall what it was like in 2000. Kimberly, on the other hand, has been enjoying retirement. She doesn't want either of them to ever have to work again. Longevity runs in her family especially, and she's concerned about them running out of money. She has been very happy so far in this bull market. They've done well, but agrees with her husband that it's wise to maybe take a look and get a second opinion, especially since some of their holdings were starting to lose money. And so being conservative by nature, they came to us. And what we did is their main thing was maintaining their lifestyle. They were fortunate enough to retire early. They sold a business. They did real well. They wanted to maintain that lifestyle. And they also wanted to go through a major remodel in their home. They wanted to stay in their existing home. It was near a country club. They liked it. Their friends were there in the neighborhood. But they wanted to maybe update the home and then also prepare it longer term for a retirement. They said, basically, we want to retire here, and there's enough bedrooms here. If either one of us gets sick, we will have in-home care. And so that was sort of part of their plan. Here was the issue here. Their current portfolio carried high interest rate risk by hiding many what we call long-duration bonds. In other words, the bond funds and ETFs that they were in were long-dated bonds. Well, guess what? As interest rates go up, the value of those bonds go down. And they lost money in these funds in 2013. But fortunate, you know, the market came back, interest rates went lower, and they were okay. But now with the Fed rate raising cycle, they remember what it was like. They've been listening to the program and well aware of what it was like in 2007. And the other thing that they were surprised to find out is one of the reasons a lot of their funds were paying extra income and a higher yield is these funds use leverage, which that's one of the ways mutual funds increase their income. They simply went and borrowed money at 1%, invested in bonds paying 3 or 4. So they were able to increase and turbo boost the yield by borrowing money. Well, that doesn't work well when interest rates start going in the opposite direction. And most of the bigger losses in the portfolio were in the leveraged funds. And this is something, if you are in a fund that's paying a high level of income, you better look and make sure it's a high quality fund and the fund is not leveraged, because you don't want to be in junk bonds and high yield funds, or especially funds that use leverage. And we see a lot of this, especially in the muni bond area. So their risk score was a 32, their portfolio was a 59. So their portfolio was twice as risky as the couple in terms of their own risk tolerance. Their essential budget, $135,000. Discretionary income, roughly $26,000. So their combined budget was roughly about $160,000 a year. Nick's pension, $21,500. Social Security, $19,000. As we took a look at this, their assets, they had their house was worth about, let me round it off to about $1.4 million. Nick's retirement assets were $500,000. Kimberly's were close to that, not far behind, about $450,000. And in their joint account, they had about $3.5 million. Total investable assets, about $4.3 million. Total assets, $5.6 million. Now, what they wanted to look at was obviously income. They wanted to maintain their lifestyle and by their very nature, very, very conservative. So what we did is we put them in a laddered bond portfolio. We did put them into some blue chip stocks. I'm not going to mention the blue chip stocks that we used, but the kind of names, household names, that these are companies that are dividend aristocrats, been around. One of the companies has been around close to 70, 80 years and raising dividends that entire period of time. That would produce an income of about $136,000, giving them a total income of about $177,000, less a budget of $160,000. They would have a surplus of around $17,000 a year. Now, on the surface, their current allocation appeared to be in line with their objectives. However, it wasn't until closer examination that we realized the bonds were long-dated bonds in their mutual funds, and a good majority of the funds that they owned that had experienced the biggest loss were because they were using leverage to increase the income. We made recommendations to eliminate the exposure to bond funds, especially given the size of their portfolio, and get rid of the leverage. The assets instead were invested in short-duration bond ladder and floating-rate bonds that would increase as rates rise. Overall risk associated with their investments was reduced substantially to the same level of their risk tolerance, right down to that 30 level versus their current portfolio, which was close to 60. In other words, their current portfolio was twice as risky as their own tolerance for risk. And one of the reasons they came in is they kept being told the same thing. Hey, just stay with it. You know, this could be, you know, remember 2013 when bonds went down in value, they came back. Well, you know, we're in a different environment than 2013 because we hit the lowest interest rates in history. And at least in my opinion, we are unlikely to hit that again in our lifetime, especially given the fact that we're getting back to trillion-dollar deficits beginning next year. So managing longevity, here's where we used specifically tailored portfolio that reduced the risk and created more predictable income.
Coming up tomorrow on Lifetime Income, Jim's guest will be Rick Sharga from Carrington Holdings, and the subject, today's real estate market and what it looks like in the future. And of course, having a place to live factors in very strongly with your retirement plannings. All right, Jim, what are we looking forward to in weeks that are coming?
I've got some great experts coming up on the program in the next couple of weeks, including, you'll like this one, the author of a new book called How Not to Die. No, we're not talking about immortality, but at least living as long and healthy as you can be. So a lot of great guests coming up in the weeks ahead. And we'll also be diving into protection strategies as well as taxes as we get closer to April 15th. So a lot of good stuff coming up in the weeks ahead. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertised with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.